So you were editing Ace when they reprinted the Heinlein Jubilee?
No. They had reprinted them already. I edited Ace briefly, and it was a very painful experience.
Why is that?
I was going through a terrible phase as a publishing company. Don Walheim had been their editor for, I don't know, a good many years.
Forever.
10 or 20 years, something like that. And he quit without warning to start his own company, but also because he was really unhappy with the way Ace was going. It had run into financial troubles. What happened was A.A. Wynn, who had started Ace, had died, and his estate had sold the company to a consortium of people who didn't know anything about publishing. And for one thing, they had paid more for it than it was really earning out, and so it didn't have the money to meet its obligations. So part of my, and toward the end, a large part of my time at Ace was answering the telephone and explaining why the check wasn't there yet.
Oh.
And it was unfortunate.
Mm.
So I didn't enjoy my tenure there. But I did, for the first time, get to read those Heinlein juveniles that I hadn't read before.
Because I ran into a lot of them. In fact, as I said, you know, I had started out reading the adult stuff and only fell into the juvenile stuff much later. And in fact, it was the Ace paperbacks where I read many of the Heinlein juveniles. I think other than Rocket Ship Galileo and Half Space Suit Will Travel, I think I read all of the Heinlein juveniles in the Ace paperbacks.
I didn't intend to take the Ace job at all, actually. I had left Galaxy because nobody should keep the same editorial job for more than 10 years, maybe more than 5 years, because you're repeating yourself after that. And I decided I didn't want to be an editor anymore, but the publisher called me up and said, we need an editor because Don has left us. You want to come in and talk about it? So I came in and talked about it, and I wasn't really that interested in it. And I said, well, I'll think about it, and I'll call you back. So I thought about it over a weekend, and then I realized I'd have fun editing other things than science fiction, because I'd been mostly editing science fiction or popular science books when I worked for Popular Science. And then I really wanted a job, so I called him up and I said, yes, let's talk money. So then I went to work for them, and it lasted about 7 months, I think.
Oh.
And the last 3 or 4, I didn't really want to be there anymore, but I didn't want to give up quite that easily. So anyway, after 7 months, I left, and then Bantam offered me a job. And I hadn't intended to do any more editing then, but I wanted to get the taste of Ace out of my mouth, so I took the Bantam job. And that was kind of fun. I stayed there 7 or 8 years, I guess, as their science fiction editor.
You seem to bounce between periods of being an editor, being
a writer.
And then you have these transitional periods where you're both.
Yes. Well, I've always been a writer as well as an editor. Or as well as anything else I was doing. And actually, there were long periods when my earnings from my after-hours writing greatly exceeded the earnings from whatever my main job was. And I finally realized that if this were so, there was no reason to have a main job. But I felt, as I think many people did and still do, that it was nice to have a paycheck every week.
Or to get the benefits.
Or to get
medical insurance.
Such as the benefits were at that time. They were not quite as profligate as they are now.
Yeah.
I never had medical insurance from any employer in my life. I do now because I married a college professor, so I have hers.
That's one way to get the insurance.
That's the way. There are other advantages to marrying her, too.
I hope so. When you're writing, do you outline and plan and all that other stuff beforehand, or does it just sort of fall out?
I don't, if I can possibly avoid it. I don't like to know where I'm going. I make it up as I go along. At some point, 2 or 3 things, separate facts or notions, come together, and I see that I have the beginning of a story. And then I start writing, and then from then on, the story tells me where it's going. Now and then, I have had the experience of having to write an outline, quite often sometimes for book publishers if they buy it on the basis of the first few chapters.
Yeah.
They want to know, I don't know why, they want to know what the rest of the book is going to be like. And so I have to write some outline that will describe the rest of the book, to which I always append a note saying, do not believe any of this. I'm not sure how it's going to go, but it could go this way or something like it. This is even worse in my few experiences with television or film people. who want these outlines and want them revised and fiddled around with to the point of total frustration, which is one reason why I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
But I've had to write outlines, and they're meaningless. I don't think in terms of what's happening. I think in terms of how the people are reacting to each other and how their world is changing around them as they see it. Anyway, I do what I have to do, but I try to avoid that.
Someone once said that they were convinced that the people at the publishing companies did not read the outlines. It was an existence proof.
I believe that's true. I believe that's true.
An outline exists. Check mark. Okay. Send them the check. Proceed. And so what I suggested was, if you were showing them the first couple of chapters in an outline, that you just have an outline that you start and you use the same outline.
They would notice if the names were different, I think.
Well, okay, so you need to write a piece of software or do a global search and replace on the names, and you know, maybe do a couple of small changes, but basically have the same outline
work.
And just
that
keep sending
work.
It.
That would work.
If they're not going to read the damn thing.
My friend and collaborator Cyril Kornbluth hated writing outlines even more than I did. And I sold one of his novels, I guess it was Takeoff, to Doubleday on the basis of maybe 10,000 words. And Walter Bradbury, who is the editor there, said, listen, we'd love to buy it. We have to have an outline to show to the editorial committee meeting. So Cyril holed up in a hotel over a weekend and wrote the rest of the novel rather than write the outline.
And then for the outline, he just has to send them every third page. Ah, when you're starting up a story, is there a common thread as to what it is that's piquing your interest when you start that story?
No. There are a lot of things that interest me, and I don't really know in advance what kind of interest it's going to be.
But I mean,
I do read a dozen different scientific magazines because I'm a big fan of science.
Yeah, well, you did a book about science as a spectator sport.
Right, Chasing Science, exactly.
That's
I do it for fun.
Yeah.
I don't do it for research. I do it for fun, but sometimes the fun turns into something that I'm going to write about or some element of what I'm going to write. So I subscribe to New Scientist, Scientific American, Science, and about 10 or 12 other specialized ones, astronomical or whatever. I did used to get more of them, but I'm trying to cut down on the number of magazines that come into the house.
Tell me about it.
That's where I get some of the ideas from, the scientific mag. Then I get other ideas just from seeing what people do or what's happening in the world or talking to someone.
Well, I'm wondering, when you're starting up the story, do you have a character envisioned or do you have a situation or, you know, do you start with a picture of something or what is it when you look, you found an interesting idea that in the back of your head is tickling a story?
Any three of the above. If I have either a character... Well, I need several different things that seem to fit together, but a character, a problem, a setting, a scientific notion that somebody has suggested or that I've thought up by myself, or sometimes it comes from what I'm doing at the time.
Yeah.
My wife and I were traveling in Italy some years ago, and among other places, we went to Pompeii. I've been to Pompeii a number of times before, but she hadn't. And we toured Pompeii pretty thoroughly. And as we were leaving, I said to her, Betty Ann, I have just thought of the most wonderful story idea I've had in years. And I wouldn't tell her what it was. I'm not telling anybody else what it was. But it's a story called Under the Mountain, and it deals with Pompeii. And as soon as I finish the current one, I'm finally going to write it. It's been like 9 years since we were there.
Yeah, sometimes these things have to percolate a while.
Well, I had other things on my mind, but I did some drafts of it, so I had a head start. But that's how that idea came to me.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing happens. The novel that I'm working on now, the first chapter of it starts with a young man living in Istanbul.
Uh-huh.
And I thought of that while we were in Istanbul.
Now, you wrote with... Cyril Kornbluth, you wrote with...
I'm very promiscuous, I'm afraid, yeah.
Well, you know, just watch what you pick up. and Jack Williamson and various other people.
Yeah.
How does writing with someone compare to writing by yourself? And also, how does it change
depending
on who you're working with?
If you're lucky in a collaborator, it's easier because you have someone else to help you over the tough spots. It's more inventive because you have somebody else thinking of ideas. And it has other less tangible benefits. The bad part is that this other guy takes half your money.
And but, it doesn't do half the work.
No. The trouble with collaborating is both sides have to do 90% of the work. It's just the way it works out. But I loved working with Cyril Kornbluth because we grew up together, really. We began trying to write together when I was maybe 18 and he was maybe 13. I don't know, less than that. And we sort of knew each other's thoughts. We wrote basically in a system in which we would come together, usually at my home in Red Bank, and we would sit around and talk for a while until we had the idea for a story somewhat in mind. We would know some of the characters, we would know what the problems were. And then we would flip a coin, and whoever lost would go up to the third floor of the house where we kept a room for Cyril with his own typewriter and his own bed and write the first four pages of the story. And at the end of page four, he would come downstairs and say, "You're on." And the other person would go up and write the next four pages. And if you do that maybe 50 times, you have a novel. They weren't perfect.
Or you have two collections of four-page segments of a novel.
See, that's the advantage of our having grown up together. We didn't really have much trouble joining the sections. It wasn't, at that point, a quite publishable novel. It needed editing, needed some false leads to be stricken out, needed serious furniture moved around from place to place. But it was basically the whole novel.
Yeah.
And I loved working with him that way. I've never been able to do it with anybody else.
No, when you did that, so now you had the four pages, and you had these interleaved four-page segments. Mm-hmm. Did one of you sit down and write over it?
Not in the process of writing, no.
But I mean in the rewrite?
In the rewriting, which I did.
Uh-huh.
That was a rule. I would always do the final draft.
And so that gave it one voice, if you would.
But it started out one voice, really.
Yeah.
The voice was very similar for both of us because we had this worldview that we shared.
Yeah. As I said, I think Cyril Kornbluth is just someone whose writing I really love. And the similarity of voice between him and you may be one reason why I have always enjoyed your stuff.
Well,
it's not that you're doing a copy of him. It's just that you guys are speaking the same dialect, and it happens to be one I enjoy listening to.
That's true, and I learned an awful lot from working with Cyril. I think maybe Cyril learned a little from me, too.
But he
had strengths that I didn't have, and I learned some of them.
Yeah.
He lacked no strengths at all, except in one serious way. He always hated his characters, and he killed them off at the end of the story. I had to talk him out of that.
And then they all died. Now, in writing with other people, like that Williamson upstart.
That Kid Williamson.
Yeah, Kid Williamson.
Was very different. We never tried to work that way. Tech is a much nicer person than I am. And the way we would do it was he lived way off in
New Mexico.
Somewhere, I don't remember the name of it, some foreign country.
Yeah, I think you need a passport to go
there. Yeah, and I lived in the civilized Northeast. And so we didn't physically sit together and write. We'd do it by correspondence. And we'd start by exchanging letters about possible things we could write about until we had a stack of correspondence that probably was thicker than the manuscript would be. And then that sweet man, Jack, would write a complete first draft all by himself. You don't find people like that everywhere. And then I would take it and I would maybe eliminate some and add some new and change things around, and that would be the manuscript that we sold. And we did, I think, 8 or 9, maybe 10 novels together that way. With great pleasure. I loved working with Jack, too.
Yeah, now, weren't a lot of those young adult novels?
The first three were. Yeah. The Undersea series were Undersea Fleet, Undersea City, Undersea Belly Button. I don't remember what the other one was.
Yeah, and those actually get reprinted with some regularity.
Yeah, they actually have sold a lot of copies over the years.
When you're doing a young adult novel, what sort of differences do you have there as opposed to your adult novels?
I didn't intentionally write any young adult novels at all. The Undersea series just worked out that way because that was the way it went. The basic difference between an adult novel of science fiction and a young adult novel of science fiction is that the viewpoint character in a young adult novel is 15. I mean, there is no other real difference.
No, but I think, and that may be a common thread for the people that have done the successful young adult novels and the ones that have actually endured, is that they didn't talk down to the kids.
That's right. They don't talk down. And they shouldn't be less complicated than an adult novel. But you do have less interest in sex, for example.
Well, no, the kids at that age have more interest in sex.
They
just don't write about it.
And the viewpoint character is probably younger.
Yeah.
And that's really, Heinlein's novels are exactly that way.
Yeah.
There's no sex in them, and the viewpoint character is a young boy, or in the case of Pod Cane of Mars, a young girl.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's the only difference.
Yeah, and some of the concerns are different, because they're not concerned with how do I get the money to feed my family or put a roof over our head. So there are other problems or issues that they're dealing with. But
but
you don't talk down to them. And those, in fact, the Heinlein juveniles I found you could read as a kid. You know, I found that you could read them when you were 15, 25, 35, and it didn't matter. They kept being good. You just found different things about them to enjoy.
I served a sentence as editor of Ace Books for a while, and I had never read some of the early Heinleins, so I read them for the first time then. They were wonderful. Kids' novels, but they were wonderful.
Yeah.